Good morning and welcome to another edition as November slips away of Community Conversations playing on Tuesday morning's morning show time slot. I'm Phil Huff, one of your hosts, and with me again today is Julie Callaline, our co-host. Good morning, Julie. Yes.
Hi, Phil. So nice to see you again as I look out my window and snow is gently falling.
Winter's
on its way.
I know it's beginning to feel a lot like Thanksgiving. And I was just inquiring with someone if the turkey trot's going to happen again this year. And I don't know. But traditionally in Sandpoint at 9 a.m. at Traverse Park on Thanksgiving Day, people converge and convene and they run around the park and they donate food to the food bank. And even if nobody else is there, I think I'm going to go and then hopefully someone's there to collect the cans. But if not, I'll drop them off at the food bank. How about you, Julie? Are you in?
No, I'm not in for any form of trotting, Phil, but I am in for sending cans if you need some extras.
Okay, very good. How have you been?
Oh, good. Hey, if I'm a little distracted during this interview, I'm just going to warn listeners. I have some interesting raptor activity happening outside my window. In addition to the snow, there are two of them and they're interested in something out in my yard. And so it's so distracting, but I'm going to do my best to carry on with the interview.
All right. Train your eagle eye on the screen.
That's right. That's right. Well, we've got a really interesting guest today, and it does relate to plants and animals outdoors and snow falling, et cetera. And that's because we're going to be talking about landscape and landscape design and just how to think about how we're going to work with our home environments with the change in climate, with climate change. And we are lucky today to have Karen Olson. Karen is the owner of Astor Plant Nursery, and she's also the main landscape architect at Sightline Landscape Architecture here in Sandpoint. Welcome, Karen.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Good to see you. And I have to let you all know that Karen is also an underwriter for KRFY, so we thank you most graciously for underwriting with us.
I thought you were about to say she's another pickleball player. I think that's where we've gotten most of our interviews from lately, Julie.
She may be, but we'll find out in a moment.
Okay. Not yet. Although we have drawn some up.
Yes, I'll bet you have. Hey, Karen, tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get into the area of landscape design, and how did you come to be here in Sandpoint?
Well, landscape design, I've always just had an interest in gardening, anything outside, beauty, art, science, and landscape architecture rolls all those interests into one. And I actually, when I was in high school, we had, just like here, at an organization called the Future Farmers of America, and we had a horticultural class and department, and we grew our own plants in the greenhouse, and then we did a big show at the Del Mar Fair in San Diego County, and we did a landscape design, and one of the colleges there gave us free rein on all their plants, which was for high schoolers, was amazing. And so we put together, you know, waterfall, a pond, all these exotic plants, and we got a blue ribbon, and we were so excited. And just looking at all the other designs, it was very inspiring. And so it's always something I've kept, even though I've gone through a few different careers, it's always something that was always in the back of my mind. And but I always thought it was in that musician realm or the art realm. It's like, oh, it's a good interest, but can you make a living at it? You know, so I did more like safe things, like teaching school and running a catering company and that sort of thing, until the kids left home, and it was like, oh, if I don't do this now, it's not going to happen. So I went off and got my, actually, I was going to go for my teaching master's degree, and they were full. And so I went trooping around, and I ran into the landscape architecture department, and they said, come on in. And I had found my tribe. They were wonderful.
Now, when I think of landscape architects, I think of Frederick Law Olmsted and Central Park, the big grand public spaces. And one of my personal heroes, Benton McKay, who's the father of the Appalachian Trail, presented in 1919 to the American Society of Landscape Architects, this plan, this vision for the Appalachian Trail. And it was really out of his sense of place that he developed it as a landscape architect, and big stuff. And how has the profession, how has it changed over the years? How has it scaled up or down to specific places? Tell us a little bit more about your point of entry.
Well, you can go anywhere with this. I think the closest large scale natural type of feature is going to the Sun Trail in Glacier Park. And so that was designed by a landscape architect. They had engineers and foresters on board, but they wanted that vision of all the vistas and the views. And they've got that. If you've ever been on that road, it's amazing. It's just a scenic feast from one end to the other. And so that's a larger scale. There's, you know, huge parks, Fresh Kills Park, which used to be a dump, and they've reclaimed that for public use and sealed off the toxins and created a beautiful, you know, natural looking island. So restored it to life and created something beautiful and useful out of a brownfield, basically. So there's all those. And then there's the little backyard, you know, designed for people who want a fire pit and a patio. So you can go anywhere. There's a lot of us that just write or just design or design build or work in the Forest Service. There's, it's just, you can go anywhere.
It's, yeah, I mean, I think they even were for Army Corps, Parks and Recs designing campsites and planners, like large-scale regional planning can happen, and then also into the area of ecology. So it is true, landscape architects show up everywhere. Yeah. On the planet, with the Lakes Commission as a landscape architect.
Yeah, from small spaces and small backyards to folks who have larger lots of land and public spaces, there's quite a few places where it impacts ourselves and our lives. And we're going to move to some questions about climate change, but tell us a little bit about maybe how the profession's changed over the years, how certain concepts have entered entered the profession that might not have been there before. How's it evolved?
Well, technology has really impacted our profession. Everything used to be done by hand, you know, drafting. And just like any other profession, it's sped it up. That's brought, you can create now a 3D model of what you're envisioning for any project and walk your client through it. As before, you're showing them two-dimensional plans on paper and maybe a perspective view of something or maybe an elevation view. Now you can go 3D and walk them through it with music, with wind blowing in the leaves, with fire and water moving. It's just, it's amazing. And, you know, landscape architecture started in large public spaces. Everybody's heard of the father of landscape architecture, Olmsted, with Central Park but it's evolved to smaller spaces. There's, you know, edible landscape, there's urban farming, there's water collection. So it's gone into all those areas of interest that people have gone into, you know, as far as, okay, how are we going to re-envision this city so that we have green space where there were an old industrial wasteland? You know, what are we going to do there? How are we going to create civic space on a busy boulevard and make it safe for bicycles, for pedestrians? How are you going to slow the traffic flow on a dangerous road? So you can do that with shapes and narrowing roadways and by, you know, plantings and different pullouts and whatnot. So there's just no limit.
I love that. And the materials of landscape implementation have changed a lot. What about those?
Oh boy, there's so much available now. It's, you know, any kind of hardscape paver you can get, you know, was just what was available at the hardware store or your local landscape yard or your local like gravel pit, but now you can get materials from Italy, you know, tiles, you can get things from all over the world, slabs of stone. My preference is to stick locally, but once in a while you have a special project that calls for something. And again, you know, with internet, with social media, you can like talk to people in different parts of the world and ask questions. Where do I find this? You know, if you need something special, special plant, special material. But yeah, just like when we used to go to the grocery stores a long time ago, it was, there were a few things in the produce section. Now there's, you know, all these exotic fruits, vegetables, you know, mm-hmm. landscape architecture is no different. There's these, all these amazing varieties and that people have created of different cultivars of plants. Again, you know, yeah. It has spread and been just as creative as all humanity.
So tell us about some of the projects you've been working on or have completed or are looking forward to work on.
We've been working a lot lately on like cottage type developments, and I love those. I love the making the most living space out of a piece of property, especially if you're developing a an old industrial site or someplace that is no longer of service and could be better used, and providing families with affordable, you know, homes within their reach. And so we've done, I think we've worked on three of those just in the past few months. And I really love that. I love creating a little, an open area that all the people can share. And then little private nooks. So you have your, you still have your space. You still have some privacy and you still have a little patch you can garden or grow whatever you want, or, you know, have a barbecue, little outdoor kitchen. But there's also that civic space, that shared space, that community space, which is in a lot of our normal neighborhoods, people are somewhat isolated in their own little home. And I just love that shared community space. So we've done a few of those lately. We've done, you know, the medical center in Pondere, the fat big restaurant, the green roof, green wall, the little courtyard space there, the Heartwood Center, just a few little bits. The latest one's Fiesta Bonita restaurant. So creating, instead of a really busy road, you know, where Walmart is and everything, it's just so busy, it's not inviting, but we put planters there and a green screen, so it'll be inviting. Mm-hmm. So we're creating, get to create an inviting space out of someplace that was like busy and uncomfortable before.
Yeah, you really could soften up those spaces that are so right. hard. Plants and mm-hmm. Some privacy make a big difference.
Right,
and a bunch of residential locations in Sandpoint that are just really cool mm-hmm. and incorporate food and beauty, basically. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Food plants can be, there's so many beautiful, I mean, just the common blueberry has great fall color, has spring flowers, you know, it's a nice little shrub that isn't going to get out of control. It's just provides you berries, you know, so there's so many different things you can include in a garden.
Now there's so many questions to ask you, and I know we want to get to one of the themes and run it through this interview, and that's mm-hmm. climate change. Right. How has climate change impacted your profession?
Well, there's just like this summer was so hot, and we immediately had so many requests for shade trees, shade places to sit. I was at a home yesterday where they said, we can't even sit here anymore. It's too warm, you know, compared to what it was 12 years ago. And, you know, but a lot of the ethics and ways we approach a design haven't really changed, because we always are being fire-wise, conserving resources, creating low maintenance landscapes so people have time to take care of them, and they have everybody's so busy now, and we try to keep the landscape design within reach of the people to keep it maintain it, you know, and not have it cost a fortune. And so even though we are addressing new issues, it's like, it hasn't, a lot of the ethics and the approach that we have always taken in design haven't changed, you know, because it's just common sense. You know, you need to take care of what you have. You need to put back what you take out of a landscape or it won't grow. You know, there's just this really checks and balances in working with living things that you have to follow, or you're going to end up with hard pan soil. If you compact it, you're going to end up with, if the nutrients are depleted, the plants won't thrive. So there's a real cause and effect, you know, in action. And it's pretty instant. So just the profession itself has always been very attuned to that.
You know, yeah, that's good to hear, I think. And but there must be some areas that you've got to have a little greater concern for, such as water use. And I would think, as you already talked about, creating enough shade for people when it's getting so darn hot.
Right.
And maybe some plant selections. And we might then get into native plants.
Mm-hmm. Well, native plants are just like domestic plants. There's some of them that are very tough and very low maintenance, and there's some of them that are very high maintenance and fussy. So native is not always, it's often a solution. It's not always the solution. Sometimes a really tough, low water domestic cultivar is the answer. So a lot of times we choose like the best solution. And I mean, every plant is native to somewhere or a cultivar thereof. Some of them don't belong in this climate. There's certain ones like I would not plant here, even though it's hardy and tough, is like the Western clematis. It's an attack plant. It's going to climb over trees, smother them. So those are considerations. Like if you go down to the bypass and the Sandpoint bypass, the clematis has taken hold there. And it's like, you can see it's climbing over trees, it's choking everything else out. So those are considerations. And just having like places for people to be, work, get food close to home, in their yards, on their property, I think that's one of the most, one of the best things you can do for curbing off climate change using too many resources, is keeping things close to home, you know, having lots of things to do. With COVID, people wanted things to do in their yard, you know, gardens. It really brought people home in a lot of ways. I could see that was a positive outcome of the whole situation.
We think of COVID, and we might go there in a bit, but one of the early first crises is with the lack of things in the grocery store.
Right.
March a year ago, and lots of conversation amongst folks about more food independence, starting with home gardens and rooftop gardens in urban areas. And that all was brought to bear because of the crisis, but it's always been a need or benefit or value. Did you find that started to influence projects in the last year?
Oh, yes. We were doing a lot of what we call urban farms. And people, they want herbs, they want vegetables, they want chickens, they want, and I think it's wonderful.
I want to drill down a little bit more into the climate change. I know in parts of the American Southwest, even 10, 15, 20 years ago, xeriscaping became a real focus because of the need for low maintenance in terms of water planting. Mm-hmm. And you hear about that a little bit up here. Is xeriscaping becoming more of a focus here because of prolonged drought potential or not?
Yes. Yes. Not only because it looks really cool, you know, because it's kind of edgy and modern and very carefree. It's a landscape that will stay looking good without a lot of care. Once it's established. I mean, anything needs care. A couple of years, you know, there's that phase where you're getting things established before they're independent. But it's not really, I think it's probably a bigger push now, but it's always been there. especially, and I think it started south and it's moving north, just like the heat, you know. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of, you know, you think of it as maybe austere, you know, very rocky and sandy, but there it can actually look quite lush. There's some plantings and ground coverings that you can use that is xeric, which means it's using less water, but it still looks great. You know, there's some fantastic, like very non-thirsty plants out there, you know.
Yeah, that's so true. And I just want to come back around to the native plants another time, and, you know, using natives in the landscape. And Phil is probably with me on this. We're both members of the Native Plant Society here in town. But, you know, it's so interesting because they, as you said earlier, some will make it anywhere and some are a little more tricky. They need the right place. But there is the right plant for every place, right? Shades.
Oh, yes.
That can help with natives and maybe even with changing climates that they need a little tweaking. But I'm going to say that I've been to your nursery and it's loaded with native plants. You have a bunch of them.
I love them.
Yes.
And even native plants can be very, very exotic. I love the native ginger we have here. It has a beautiful heart-shaped leaf. It'll thrive in the shade. Has that gorgeous kind of a brown red flower. That's
like
stunning.
A little jester's hat or something. It's cool.
And it'll
flower
spread along underneath the, underneath the evergreens. And, but you're right. And it's just picking where that native wants to be. So if you have a creek bed, and then you can have those, the plants that need a lot of moisture, you know, it is picking the right place, the right, you know, amount of moisture, the amount of organics in the soil. So it's picking the right place for that plant.
Yeah, it's not just selecting a plant, but looking at the holistic approach to the site. What can it support? Because ginger out in the open sunlight is not going to do as well as having its feet damp under a cedar.
Right. It will gradually just kind of, it'll go away after a while. It'll have it there for a while. It'll just kind of dwindle away.
We see a lot of development pressure in our area, a lot of new buildings coming up and new developments coming in, and not all of them are going to be, the individual owner is not going to come ahead of time and consider the location, the developer is. Mm-hmm. And so do you find some of the work shifting towards developers rather than individual homeowners? And if not, what would you might do to encourage that?
Most of the projects that we've worked on, we do get, there's a developer or a contractor. We usually are in contact with owner as well. And sometimes the developer is the owner. So in some of the cottage developments, the developer was the owner. And in some, we're going through an architectural firm. So we don't ever meet the people. We're just, they tell us what they want and we, you know, do it. But even in those, you know, I'm still looking at those things of, will it look great with the minimal maintenance? Will it take low care? Or not a fan of huge lawns unless you have a need for one, you know, like you have a dog and you need a place to run around, or you have grandkids, or we end up designing more lawns away than we end up putting in. And the same in like a commercial development type area. I prefer to put in trees and shrubs that are going to be there for generations and without a lot of care.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense for every day and for the future of the climate. Mm-hmm. So when you think about climate change, what worries you most as a landscape designer?
I think that the unknown. You know, because we don't really know what's going to happen. We have some good ideas. And a lot of people in my profession are working in Florida and they're designing for higher water. And high tides have become common, you know, and flooding has become common in some areas where it was rare. And it's that unknown, you know, is it going to change slowly? Is it going to change fast? I mean, are we going to reach a certain point where all of a sudden it's so arid, trees can't survive? The Forest Service says that in 10 years here, we're going to start seeing another forest. We noticed on satellite imagery that we use a lot to look at different places and figure out topography and vegetation and what exists on sites already, that all of a sudden one day they put new pictures up and we were floored because, you know, 10 years ago, the picture is very green. Our forests are verdant green. And now they had more of a brown overall look, you know, that had changed that fast in just one cycle of, and a lot of it was windstorms had knocked down a lot of forests. So there were a lot more, of the ground showing here and there, but just overall, it looked more arid. Like you would see like in Lewiston or something, you know, that kind of a color of a more arid environment. And so everybody in my office was gathered around the new aerial came out. We're just going, whoa, you know, that you don't realize day to day. And then all of a sudden you see something from a few years ago and now, and, yeah. You know, I mean, what will it be like in 30 years?
So, yeah. There's some things that are evident. The growing seasons obviously shifted longer.
Right.
And yet there are extremes that occur inside of that season that didn't occur before. So right. It doesn't necessarily mean the number of frost-free days, for instance, has increased. It may even decrease.
Right.
We just don't know, but we do know that we're going to see these changes. I'm imagining one of the impacts, and I've heard some of this from the Forest Service and others, is with noxious weeds, you know, the counterpart to what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And weeds fill any vacuum, and if there's any vacuum created by changing conditions, we know weeds will take advantage of it. So,
And insects. So that's another thing is like the mosquitoes at our place, we had black clouds and mosquitoes forever. I've lived in the same place for 20 years and then just up the road, another 10 years. So all of a sudden one year they were gone. And what is going on here? And then my friends are like, oh, we used to drive the car and there'd be bugs all over our windshields and there's not anymore. And so that big of a change within like 3 years it was literally black clouds at our house and mosquitoes. And now I can go outside and there's none. And so that was a pretty, you know, base of the food chain, you know, insect is not where it always was, you know, what's going on there. And so things like that are pretty frightening to me.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, those are things to be concerned about. We need our insects and we need things to be green, not brown. So big concerns, but you must have some hope too as a designer. And are there things that you're hopeful about?
I really hope that, that we learn to be good stewards. You know, I know that sounds like an old phrase, but I don't know. I used to teach science and biology and my kids would go, oh, you're just a tree hugger. And I'd say, well, that's not the way I look at it. It's like, I just think I want to take care of things. You know, it's just like in your own backyard, are you going to fill it up with toxins? Are you going to strip it? Are you going to, you know, you wouldn't do that. But we expect nature to give us and give us and give and give, no matter how we treat it. And that's illogical and unreasonable. You can't take money out of your bank account endlessly without putting more in, you know, and that balance is what I hope we learn to do, you know, that there's so many good people, and there's so many great things going on, you know, that people trying to work within a sustainable future. So, you know, and we don't hear about that as much as we should. We hear the scary stuff. And there is scary stuff, but I look for those things because I need to hear that for, you know, to.
Yeah, we've got to have a little hope, right?
Exactly. Yeah. You just don't want to look at the negative because I think there's probably there is negative for sure, but there's also a lot of positive.
It seems like the landscape design really works on two levels. And one is more of the individual consumers and mm-hmm. their private space, and the other is the more public space. And mm-hmm. carrying that thought of hope forward, if mm-hmm. you could make recommendations, say, collectively to individuals as to what they might start considering to do, I think we'd love to hear that. And then mm-hmm. be thinking about the same question you might present to, say, officials who would be working on a larger scale. Mm-hmm. What would your recommendations be for each?
So like for a private, residential person versus a business?
Yeah, let's say someone's listening and they've just moved here, or they're thinking mm-hmm. about moving here. They're listening to mm-hmm. this live streaming from somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And they're like, hey, okay. I think I'm going to move to Sandpoint. Mm-hmm. What would you advise them to start thinking about doing before they even made the move in terms of setting themselves up for a good location, a good residence?
Okay, so if they haven't chosen their property, or they're yeah. just, are you just talking about what they do with it once they have it?
Either way, whatever you think okay. Be most effective.
I was actually talking with a couple that are moving in from out of town this morning. They had bought a place, and you know, I always encourage people to live someplace for a while before they do anything drastic and see how you use the place. What do you really need before you go hog wild and build a bunch of expensive stuff or tear up a lot of ground and do something? It's like, be there for a while. And especially for residential people, see what you want. You know, when you're going to go eat in your yard, where do you sit? How much space do you need? Do you have a lot of friends over? Do you have just a few people? And then create your spaces that you want, you know, around what you really are going to use, not some picture on, you know, the internet or a magazine, or, you know, you can see so much on the internet now. So I get these pictures a lot where people show me, I want this. And it's like, well, are you going to use that? You know?
Yeah. And where it might fit in your land. Right. Like it doesn't,
and
it
how much you got.
Work out everywhere. Right.
Right.
So a
lot of times I'll just say to people, let's just, you know, because when you disturb, like the place I went this morning is a beautiful forested site and great view. I was like, why change it? You're just going to create, work for yourself. It's going to cost a lot to do it. And then you have all the maintenance. And right now it's sustainable. If things are growing there, looks beautiful. Maybe just start with a few pots on your patio and go from there and see how much you really do want to change.
Act slowly is what you're saying. Think right. and observe your site before mm-hmm. making big changes. Mm-hmm.
Slowly and deliberately. And maybe the advice will be the same, but maybe it's different. Mm-hmm. Let's say we could magically convene this symposium of city and county planning and zoning folks. Mm-hmm. And you had the opportunity to present to them mm-hmm. your hopes for the future of our area. Mm-hmm. What would you urge them to do or consider?
Well, we work with them a lot already. And they're great. On a whole, I've found them very helpful. And mostly concerned about, you know, public safety, health, the owners of homes, they're safe, you know, fire, you know, just common stuff. But they've been very open to creative ideas. And like the city itself, they have a street tree requirement that you need to plant, you know, so many street trees along here for shade and just the beauty. So we don't end up with a, you know, wall-to-wall sidewalks and driveways sort of a thing. So I've already found them very open and very helpful towards that, you know, those kind of goals. So.
And not only that, the city parks and recs director mm-hmm. is a landscape architect.
Right. Ooh. I met her. She's wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maeve.
Yes.
Yeah. Excellent.
Gotta help. Well, as we start to come to a close, what else? What have we missed here, Karen? Are there other important things we need to be thinking about in our landscape design for changing climate?
Hmm. Yeah, see, that's the hard one for me, is because what my approach and the way that even the profession approaches design has already been so geared towards preservation of our ecosystem and our environment, and creating wonderful spaces for people and green space for nature to be, you know, integrated into that. And there's an organization, the ASLA, it's American Society of Landscape Architects, which has a wonderful website, and there are all kinds of committees and task forces that you can find solutions to almost any problem. Like, they're working on it, you know, and these are some of the most creative, brightest minds, new students, young people, old people, experienced people, sharing ideas and coming together to solve problems. They have a magazine you can get online or subscribe to, but just seeing, this is amazing me how creative people are. It's like, why did I not think of that? It's like obvious, like there, you know, but I'm just constantly delighted that we talked about technology a little bit, just that interaction with people to be able all over the world, be able to share ideas and help find solutions together.
Yeah, what a nice thought as we come to an end. And we've mentioned the Association of Landscape Architects as a mm-hmm. reference, and then there's yourself. Folks could get in touch with you if they would like mm-hmm. to know more, or give you a call and have you mm-hmm. Work for them. And what is your contact info?
Well, I have an email, it's kolson@sightlinedesign.net. You can also just find my website, it's just sightlinedesign.net. And all my contact information is there. Or I'm usually at the nursery, it's 924 Superior Street. And we love chatting with people, hearing about their gardens, hearing about what they're doing and their ideas. And if I have to watch myself, because I get out there and I have a ton of work to do in the office, and I will get out there and be sidetracked for 4 hours just talking to people about different things, you know, and then I'll head for the office and I'll find somebody running. It's like going grocery shopping at some point, you know, you're always running into people and friends.
Yeah. Well, that's a good positive note to end on. So if anyone's looking for a 4-hour coffee clutch, they can look you up on Google. Google knows everything, and come to Astor Gardens. And we want to thank you for joining us today, Karen Olson, owner and landscape architect, Astor Gardens and Sightlight Design. And if you've missed the beginning of this and want to hear the whole show, you can always tune in to our podcast or go to our podcast on krfy.org and click on the podcasts. And as always, join us every Tuesday at 8 a.m. at 88.5 FM, or if you live stream at krfy.org. And Julie and I hope to have everyone back next Tuesday. Thank you.